Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. This is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very gladly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. It's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number on the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the limit and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I appreciate you giving us that breakdown of a disclaimer. It's very, very important, ladies and gentlemen. There are some first-time callers. I'd like to ask you for your first name only, and it will show that you had listened to the disclaimer. And that's important for me because one day I expect to have a knock on the door, a badge draped across my nose, saying, we'd like to talk to you about practicing law without a license. And then we can use these audios to back up. I don't care if you make up a name. Doesn't bother me. Just as long as I have a name associated with this phone number. So we'll start with Union, Missouri, ending in 8964. May I have just your first name only, please?
First name is Jerry.
Jerry, welcome to the call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Next is from Washington, Virginia, and that would be ending in 8290. First name only, please. Hello?
Hello?
Yes. May I have your first name only, please?
This is Armenta.
Armenta. Oh, hi, Armenta. How are
hi.
You?
I'm well.
Good. Good. Welcome to the call. All right. Others that are, well, there's one more here on the call. Let's grab them. And that would be Los Angeles, ending in 8356. May I have just your first name only, please? Los Angeles, ending in 8356. You can make up a name. Don't care. All right. Just put you down as not having given it. All right. Before we get started, I want to notice a particular gentleman that has shown up, Mr. Allen from Wisconsin. It has been forever and a day. Allen, welcome back.
Thank you. Check in and listen, see what's cooking up, what's going on.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you. Good to see you again. Ladies and gentlemen, Allen is one heck of an investigator. He's made trips to the Capitol and has also networked with other influential people in our country who are desperately trying, as I am and all of us are, to restore return the Republic back to the vision of our founding fathers. Allen, welcome. It's good to see you again.
Thank you.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yep. You're welcome. All right. I have something to say before we get started, and then we'll turn the call over to PJ. Question is, what are some of the rights that we as Americans enjoy today that maybe the colonists did not have back in the mid-1700s? The answer is none. The answer is that the absolute, raw, naked power our founding fathers memorialized in the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America for independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Articles of Confederation, a constitution for the United States of America, cannot be diminished nor demolished without a constitutional convention. Why? Because these words did not create our rights and immunities to begin with. These rights and immunities preexisted the founding of our nation. Read the scripture inscribed on our Liberty Bell. It's quoting from Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, chapter 25, verse 10. It reads, quote, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all inhabitants thereof," end quote. The Liberty Bell is a huge bronze bell that symbolizes freedom in the United States of America. Why would the colonies be interested in ringing a bell that had a Bible verse on it? And what was the basis for this declaration? And why would a group of politicians think it important that a bell should have a Bible verse crafted on it and displayed? Who were those that founded our nation to begin with? And I quote, "From a small group of Christians in the north of England who had decided that the creator of the universe had placed the longing for liberty in the hearts of men, and that liberty would be first experienced by those free and self-determined through the worship of God," end quote. The scriptures are all about liberty. These colonists took the scriptures literally. They truly believed that the Almighty One had delivered Israel out of Egypt. They truly believed that the Almighty One had promised Israel a promised land. They truly believed that Yahushua, the Messiah, whom most call the Christ Jesus, had come to set men free from the tyranny of sin and its slavery. Referenced chapter, book of John, chapter 8, verse 31 and 32. Then Yahushua said to the Jews who believed him, quote, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," end quote. Simply stated, our founders saw self-government originating in the scriptures. Our founders memorialized these freedoms found in the scriptures in the founding documents, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America for independence, the Northwest Ordinance, the Articles of Confederation, and a constitution for the United States of America. So back to the question, what are some of the rights that we as Americans enjoy today that maybe the colonists did not enjoy back in the mid to late 1700s? As you know, I host a nightly teleconference call here and at Freedoms Radio. Each Tuesday at 9 o'clock Eastern, we deal with the topic of jurisdiction, to which this question strikes to the very heart of the matter. This is pretty much the thoughts that I share with our students. In the beginning, we the people, acknowledging the Almighty One as our sovereign and creator, and we, man, his creation, came together first as colonists, then as state citizens, organizing our respective state governments through our voice, that is, our state constitutions. We ordered our states to create a federal zone, quote, 10 miles within the seat of power, all territories, possessions, and enclaves, end quote. And you will, of course, find this at Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. This was formalized in 1789. God, man, man's creation, in that order. Remember the universal rule, the created is never equal to or greater than its creator. Then in 1871, man's creation, the House of Representatives and the Senate collectively, called the Congress, created the Act of 1871. These two houses, already enjoying a very limited form of government under our Constitution of 1789, took We the People's organic document and copied it into the congressional record. Why did they do this? What did this accomplish? What purpose did this serve? With no constitutional authority to do so, the Congress created a separate form of government specifically for the District of Columbia. a 10-mile square parcel of land. See the Acts of the 41st Congress, Section 34, Session 3, Chapters 61 and 62. The Act, passed when the country was weakened and financially depleted in the aftermath of the Civil War, was a strategic move by foreign interests. Read into the term foreign interests, international bankers, and read further and just say the word Rothschild. These people were intent upon gaining a stranglehold on the coffers and the neck of America. Congress cut a deal with these international bankers, specifically Rothschilds of London, to incur debt to these bankers. And because the bankers were not about to lend money to a floundering nation without serious stipulations, they devised a way to get their foot in the door of the United States of America. The Act of 1871 actually formed a corporation called the United States. Are you a United States citizen? The corporation, owned by foreign interests, moved in, shoved the original Constitution aside. And with the Act of 1871, the organic Constitution was defaced, in effect vandalized and sabotaged. When the title was capitalized from its original upper and lower case sensitive expression, and the word for was changed to the word of in the title. Capitalization is not insignificant when one is referring to a legal document, and this seemingly minor alteration has had a major impact on every subsequent generation of Americans since. The Constitution of the United States of America is the Constitution of the incorporated United States of America, an incorporation you may find, by the way, on Dun and Bradstreet. It operates in an economic capacity and has been used to fool the people into, one, unknowingly becoming indentured and indebted to the new corporation, the United States, and two, it governs the Republic. My fellow Americans, it does not govern the Republic. Now, the Congress, by way of the Act of 1871, now had the instrument to create on its own and by through it, its own government, in addition to that we the people allowed and permitted the legislative branch of government to create. This modified, unconstitutional legislative branch, now over two separate governments, even had its own ready-made citizens. The 14th Amendment citizens, created just a few years prior, and began to create other artificial things known as persons, individuals, and corporations. And then for their new creation of persons and individuals, the Congress began to create permission to do, and this is a quote, permission to do that which is otherwise illegal, end quote. We call this thing a license. For these persons, it was necessary to get a marriage license, a fishing license, a driver's license, and anything else you can imagine. What this did is, by you petitioning the government for these licenses, was to affirm you're one of their citizens. This can be corrected, by the way, if you have had such things issued to you in the past. We can talk about that later. The Civil War, in part, was about ending slavery. However, this was much more of a marketing ploy than its true purpose. One only has to read the published papers of such notables as Abraham Lincoln, who said at the fourth debate with Stephen Douglas at Charleston, Illinois, September 18, 1858, in which he said in part, quote, I will say then that I am not, nor have ever been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races. That I am not now, nor have ever been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, they must be in the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race. And I say upon this occasion, I do not perceive that because the white man is to have the superior position, that the Negro should be denied anything. End quote. Wow. On an aside, did you know that Lincoln said he did not want to free the slaves unless they were to be deported? Look at the creation of the African state known as Liberia. Liberia is the only black state in Africa never subjected to colonial rule and is Africa's oldest republic. It was established on land acquired for freed U.S. slaves by the American Colonization Society, which was founded at a colony at Cape Macerata in 1821. See, in 1821, they were already preparing this move, this segue. The Civil War had far more sinister ramifications to it. We, the people, became very confused about the word people being different from the word persons. In our common language, the words were synonyms. They were synonymous. But in law, then and now, they are not. In 1901, the Supreme Court of the United States took up what is referred to as the Bidwell decision. And here, for the first time, the term U.S. citizen was defined in law. Remember, this is after the 14th Amendment. Remember, the 14th Amendment's purpose was only to elevate what was previously considered to be a two-legged farm animal, a slave, into something called personhood. These are the three definitions to a United States citizen, or land, for that matter. There is the territorial citizen, and there is the state citizen, both jurisdictional statements. There is also a non-jurisdictional U.S. citizen, being a reference by others around the world referring to those who live south of Canada and north of Mexico, west of the Atlantic and east of the Pacific. The territorial citizen is, quote, subject to the Congress, end quote, while the state citizen is still subject to the Congress. However, in this matter, the Congress is limited to legislating over the state citizen, quote, bound by the chains of the Constitution, end quote. We should notice the case sensitivity of the word citizen when we read legal documents. Have you ever heard a judge say, quote, don't bring that Constitution into this courtroom, end quote, or something to that effect? Why does the court treat state citizens as though they were territorial citizens? Well, this is because you are presumed to be subject to the Congress and without stipulation. Unless you properly rebut the assumption, not by your declaration, but by you keeping the burden of proof upon them to prove on the court record you are a federal citizen. Do you get it? Assert nothing. There's a rule of law, a maxim that says the one who asserts upon challenge, failing to evidence the assertion, invalidates the assertion. Then in 1930, the Social Security Act came into existence for those federal U.S. citizens that they created. The Social Security Act was only for the creatures created by the Act of 1871. A few years later, the Buck Act came into existence, and once again, the Supreme Court took up the question of what is a U.S. citizen, and this became known as the Hooven decision. This decision in the Supreme Court of the United States, once again, telling you who you are by way of jurisdiction. What laws apply to you? And who may charge you, and how they may charge you. Because we, the people, ignored this bit of important information. The trap had been set. All you have to do is to step into it by agreeing you are a U.S. citizen, or by using terminology that expresses the same, that is, you are a person, or that you reside in the state of whatever, state of Georgia, state of New York, as opposed to New York, one of the freely associated compact states. Also keep in mind that those born well before the Civil War, who knew who they were, are now have died and already passed on. The new generation only knew what their parents had taught them. That's sad. So where does this leave us to the question today? Because of our own lack of knowledge, ignorance, we don't know to exercise rights and immunities that we have to enjoy. So if anything, through our own collective ignorance, we actually have less rights today to enjoy than our progenitors. Here tonight, listen as PJ will share with you how he operates in a courtroom and can show you how to operate in a courtroom to where your rights and your liberties are respected. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ.
Thank you. Yeah, I need to study that. Did you say it was 1817? Is that when
1871, the Act of 1871.
Act of 1871. Huh, practically the 1900s. I just haven't studied that very much, but I did. I was in the Midwest, and I was in Nebraska, and I went to the legislative books, and I went through each of them, and I looked at the enactment clauses in them, and from the way back in 1765, I think. I think it was 1765. I don't know. I went way back to the very first one, and it said the enacted by the people of Nebraska. Okay, every single book I would open, the first page would say enacted by the every law would say enacted by the people of Nebraska. And then, when you get to 1913, they changed it. Enacted by the state of Nebraska, I think it said, or enacted by the legislature of the state of Nebraska. They changed it from the people of Nebraska to the, at least to the entity, the state of Nebraska. Now, you're not going to be able to overcome that. Because that's in operation. But as far as applying it to you, they still have to prove that the written laws that they're bringing into the courtroom. I'm not in a courtroom trying to prove that I'm not a federal citizen, and I'm not even asking them to prove that I'm a federal citizen. They have when you go to a state or federal court, they have a statute that you're being charged with, and you need to challenge them to produce evidence that you're subject to that statute and that the activity you did is to be governed by that statute, and the activity was within the land jurisdiction of that statute. So it's three elements there. And they have to prove all three elements for the court to have administrative authority to have jurisdiction of the matter. So let's just say they're bringing you in for a gun violation. You get pulled over and you got a pistol laying on your car seat, and you got 8 bullets in it, and hollow points, and it's loaded and ready to go. We got the safety on, just like a good marksman would have, and it's there as you need it. But anyway, they claim it's a violation of law because you don't have a permit, and you're supposed to lock up the bullets in the glove compartment, and you're supposed to lock up the gun and disassemble it in the trunk of the car, whatever. Whenever they bring those charges against you, you can challenge in court. You do not wait for trial. You do this immediately, and you do it before you even arraignment, because they have to prove that they have authority to bring you into the arraignment process. And basically, they have to prove that written law that they're bringing in the claim is acts upon you, the activity that they claim you're doing, and in the land, in the area, in the space that you're doing, they claim you're doing the activity. They have to produce that evidence on the record before the court is supposed to move forward. Now, the courts ignore this when you bring it. Most courts ignore it, not all of them. The courts that I've been into that did not ignore it and required the prosecution to produce that evidence, prosecution would fail miserably. But most of the judges don't make them do it. Now, I have a friend that brings in U.S. Marshals. He pays them to be there. And he instructs the judge that the Constitution, the constituted law, and he has to get evidence from the moving party of the three elements of jurisdiction. And if he can't do it, and he continues to proceed, he informs the judge that a U.S. Marshal will arrest him for violating his rights, because the United States courts do not have authority to come against a man without evidence of the three elements of jurisdiction. Now, that can operate in a parking ticket. It can operate in operation of an motor vehicle's operator's driver's license. It can operate in a marriage license. It can operate in a property tax issue, state taxes, federal taxes, every tax that they bring against you. This process operates. For the U.S. courts to have jurisdiction, they have to prove it. Even on a parking ticket. I've had many parking tickets where I just wrote a short brief and required that they produce the three elements, evidence to cover all the elements of jurisdiction, essential jurisdiction. And they cancel the tickets. I have one friend, he got 97 tickets one year, and he went ahead and paid, allowed it to go to a guilty charge on two of them because it was pretty egregious. And then, but the other 95, he won his cases by challenging if the moving party had all the elements of jurisdiction to proceed against him. Now, the main thing is, you have to do something at a specific location for the U.S. courts to have jurisdiction. They do not have general jurisdiction everywhere on every activity. So they have to produce that evidence. We're focusing a lot on property tax these last couple of weeks. We're actually a couple of years, really. Property, if you own a house and the state doesn't own an interest in that land, they have no taxing authority. Most land in America, it appears they have no taxing authority. Yet all that land is virtually, almost all the land is taxed. So we're going in and we're challenging them to produce that evidence. And they will kill people. They won't kill the people that we help do this, but they will kill people like us that help people that do that. So, people have been challenging property taxes for a lot of years, and that's a very interesting, and it's a very key point, because a lot of people are paying enough taxes in two or three years as they paid on the property. They might have bought the property for $5,000 years ago, and now they're paying $5,000 taxes a year. Of course, it's an inflated difference, but they're paying enough. Huge amount of taxes on land that's completely paid for, and they have no legal reason to pay taxes. Same way, if you have a right to own that land, it cannot be taxed. Same way with your income. If you have a right to pick a vocation, and you're not doing it on government land, and you're not a U.S. person, corporation, or franchise, or association, or anything like that, they have no legal authority to apply a tax on you for the income that is generated by your work. They do not want anybody to know this because it undermines their status agenda. If everyone knew the law, the United States would probably be bringing in 85% less money than they do now. And they would have 85% less control of people's lives. And when they would control people's lives 85% less, the people would actually get up every day and realize that, hey, the United States is not controlling us, so we need to take responsibility and govern our own communities. And when people do that, when they take pride in their own communities, ghettos disappear, justice is dished out, whatever level it has to be to restore a sound community. And you don't have schooling systems that are designed to keep the people ignorant. Even the colleges are designed to keep people ignorant now. It's pretty bad. So, Michael, is that is there any main? I was going to mention years ago, Michael talked about, you know, the laws that they brought forward had a lot of a biblical base to it. I don't know what year they stopped doing it, but when our country was founded, you were a senator or a congressman, however they did it, you wanted to bring a legislative bill to the floor, the bill had to have a biblical statement in it. Where in the Bible does God support the law that you're presenting? If let's just say you're presenting, you want to put a law in the books, thou shalt not commit abortion, for example. You put in Exodus, just simply, thou shalt not murder. And then you could pull it out of a couple other areas in the scriptures, thou shalt not murder. And that would be your required, it would meet your requirement for a biblical statement of law to support the law that you're bringing before the legislature to vote on. They don't do that anymore. Matter of fact, if you try to do that, they'll try to make a big huff about it and say that you're mixing religion with politics, and church and state separation is a cardinal law, I guess, even though it's not biblical and it's not even in the Constitution and it's not in our history either. Biblical law had the church, God's word had a tremendous impact, the leading impact on all the founding of the country. Once you get away from that, you don't have much of a country. So, Michael, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Press star 2
okay.
On your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand. And when you do that, I will unmute your phone so that you can speak directly with PJ. I encourage you, everyone on this call, this is an opportunity. There's no cost. Just ask your questions, please. On an aside, while you're welling up the courage to press star 2 on your keypad, I should also mention for the people on Freedoms Radio, you will see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the middle of your monitor. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or question. Outside the rectangle, you will see a place to put your contact information. Once done, hit submit, and I will give voice to your comment or question. Here's a little trivia for you. When did we start, and why did we rise when a judge entered the courtroom? All stand. Why did we do that? Anybody? Press star 2 on your keypad, if you can tell me.
Well, in 1970-something, Laugh-In was a program on TV, and they would always say, here come the judge, here come the judge.
There you go. All right. Alan raised his hand. Go ahead, Alan. Tell us why everyone stood when a judge walked in the room.
Well, they did not rise to the judge. They rose to the honor of the Bible, which was in the courtroom.
Which the judge carried with him into the courtroom. That's absolutely correct. Absolutely. Where do I send your $10,000 award for this?
If a judge carries the Bible into a courtroom now, they'll petition to have it removed. You know that?
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep. You will not find a Bible in the courtroom. It's technically outlawed by both state
or
and federal.
Or the Ten Commandments on the wall in some of these places.
Well, you were talking about abortion. That's commandment number 5, thou shalt not kill.
Right.
Actually, it says thou shalt not murder. You're allowed to kill somebody. Not a problem. Somebody breaks into your house, you can kill them. You go to war.
You're killing me, Mike. You're killing me, Mike.
Kill them. I am. But you shall not murder.
About members of Homeland Security.
Yeah, you get away from God's word, and it turns into a bad society. And we don't want to turn into a bad society. That's why we have these. Yeah, I know, but we can bring it back. That's not a problem at all. Any questions out there? Mike, I see any hands up?
No one has raised their hand. Alan raised his hand to answer the question. I have to get $10,000 to him now for answering it correctly. Boy, that hurt, but I wish somebody else had raised their hand. Alan's got more money than we know what to do with. He doesn't need it. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Otherwise, we're going to have a disappointing early call tonight.
All the trips to Washington get expensive.
Yeah. Alan, if you ever want to do research, we work with an individual that used to print out the portion of the law, of the statutes at large, that said that the Social Security number cannot be used for identification purposes. And you cannot do a Google search on that and find it anymore. They hid it up. We need somebody to go into statutes at large and find that portion. Because this individual, he said every year, he's a lawyer, he said every year he would print out about 200 copies of that. And he would pass it out to people that were going to go in to open up bank accounts. He said he'd just take that document in with them. When they asked for the Social Security number while he was opening a bank account, they just pass that document to the clerk or the bank officer and say, you better read this before you start demanding a Social Security number from me. It's illegal for you to do that. Here's the law that says it's illegal. It says I can offer to give it, but you cannot request it, demand it. You can ask for it, but you cannot put any pressure on me to give it to you for any reason except for Social Security administrative purposes. So if you can find that, that would be wonderful. I've just been too busy to get down there and do it. And this other guy, he says he can't remember where it's at. And he hasn't had time to get down there and look it up yet.
Because of Medicare, they switched from the Social Security number to a regular, I believe it's a 7-digit or 9-digit number. And they obliterated the Social Security number for that reason.
I think if you have a Social Security number now, it's 9 digits, isn't it?
Yes.
3, 2, and 4?
That is correct. But the reason for that is for the Medicare number. The Medicare number your Social Security number was your Medicare number. But now it is not. They have changed it. And one of the reasons why.
If you can find the legal documents that support that, I'd love to look at it.
I've got it. Yeah, I've got several of them.
Yeah, if you can give that to us in a brief format, that would be wonderful. We could do some good stuff with that stuff.
Okay. Cool. Thank you very much, Alan.
I did. We have done it.
Send us a list of the research you've done. Maybe it'll help us give an understanding of your expertise, and you might be able to work together. Metal sharpens metal, and me and the people I work with, we can't do everything. We got to delegate stuff to people that do a good job in areas.
All right. Our next caller that raised her hand is Armenta. Welcome, Armenta.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
Pleasure as always.
thank you. I have a question, and I wanted to, form my words in the right way to ask about immigration. There's some stories, and there was a young lady a few years back that had a situation where she and her husband, being married for years, and she was here with him for years. I think they were probably married for about either 14 to 20. It was a long time. They even had a 15-year-old child and here in the United States, but she never went and got her citizenship. And he divorced her, and ICE and I don't know who else, but they came in the middle of the night to take her back, but she has two children here. And so that's not necessarily the person I want to ask about, but I do want to ask about situations with immigration and what kind of laws are out there to help protect people. If they have situations where they have ended up being here, they came on a visa. There's one story, and this one is the one I'm asking particularly about, a man that came on a visa from overseas, and he came as a pastor to minister in a church and work in a church in Texas. And so he was working there for a while, and the head pastor began to, and probably beforehand, was entering into some very unholy activities and ungodly things. And he wanted him to buy into it and be a part of it, and he said he couldn't do that. And so it became kind of a struggle there, and so the guy left, and he still was on his visa, but then the visa expired, and he even has a social security number and pays taxes and everything. What do you do about people like that?
I don't know. This is pretty intense conversation here. I mean, I shouldn't say intense, but when you come into a nation is a mm-hmm. group of people. Okay, if you come here, let's just say Michael would own a farm in the middle of Florida or horse ranchers. If you get on your boat, you live in Spain, you get on a boat, you go straight to Michael's place. You're coming to Michael. Okay, it's very possible that the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction. But when you come here and you go to the federal government and you ask for a license to come here, green card, whatever that other stuff is, see, that's different. See, you're actually coming to them, to it. So I've always wanted to have somebody, if I owned a business, I always wanted to have somebody come. Let's just say if I did own 100 acres or 1,000 acres of land.
Sure.
And there's some skilled people from from Mexico that, you know, they could come here and make 10 or 15 times more money per hour than they could where they're at. And they would, and they'd be so thankful, and they'd be such a blessing to be here. And I would, let's just say I brought them in to my land to work. I think I could do that without going through the United States. I think I have a right. I have a right, and they have a right to do that, as long as they're not coming in to be to do any crime.
Right.
So anyway, the difference is that, you know, your friends, when they come in here, a friend of yours, it sounds like he came in here under a visa. If you come in here under a visa, then you're kind of on their railroad track, and they could send you back home on that same railroad track. Michael, does that make sense to you? Am I explaining this right?
Yeah, it sounds right, but I, frankly, I don't know anything about immigration.
I don't either. I do know that if they don't have Interpol records on you, and you and they find you on American soil, and they just ask you, you know, where are you from? You just say Arkansas or any area, and they have to prove that you're from someplace else. You don't have to prove where you're from. They have to prove you're from someplace else. And if there's no Interpol record on somebody, they can't prove that. Now, if they see you coming across the border, it might be a little different. But if you're on this if you're on this side of the border and they grab you, it doesn't make what language you know, if you don't have any papers that says you're from Spain or whatever, or Mexico or Germany or whatever, it doesn't make what language you talk. They can't prove that you're not from here. So. But when you come up, when you come into a country and you start going for their permission through the United States, you're actually coming to them, to their jurisdiction, which is a limited part of the land jurisdiction of America. It's a small part of America that you're coming to when you do that. That's what a United States citizen is. It's somebody that, their income is taxable no matter where they make it in the world, because they are considered domiciled perpetually in American in United States land, not American land, not my 1,000 acres of land. It's that's one way to look at it. I just don't know. I know they play hardball. You play hardball with them, and they play hardball right back, and they just ship you right back.
Right.
I don't think it's biblical, because God owns the world. Man doesn't own the world. And God says, you know, man is allowed to travel the world. He's not allowed to come and live on my land perpetually, but he's certainly allowed to pass over my land if with reason, you know. Otherwise, man couldn't travel. But okay. It's called passage rights.
Sorry, we didn't have an answer for you, Armenta.
Yeah. Just don't.
Yeah. That's okay. I just thought I would ask. This is something I've thought about before, and, you know, just wanted to find out, because so many of us, out of ignorance, we look to, okay, well, so-and-so needs a visa, or people, you know, need a visa, and then if something goes awry, then you're kind of like stuck, or you get sent back.
Yeah. If I was born in a foreign country and I wanted to get to America, I would get into America, and I would say Arkansas every time they ask me, Arkansas. If I didn't have an Interpol record on me.
But if there's an Interpol record, that doesn't work.
But if there's no record out there, most, you know, a high percentage of people, there's no record anywhere in the world on them. There's nothing.
Wow.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you very, very much. Next is Brian, followed by Norman, followed by Jennifer. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi, Michael. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, wall to wall.
Thank you. PJ, I've heard you say, you know, as long as there's no harm done to the individual, it's, you know, typically allowable to associate. I've had a lot of friends go through domestic violence situations over the last few years. And, you know, they were abused probably more than the woman was in the situation. And in the course of protecting themselves, both of them fell down and injured themselves. And that person was designated for a domestic assault, if you will. So I'm wondering if those types of situations are addressable, or does, you know, the other person's...
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
If you, if you're standing on government land and you're a government resident, you're going to be in a government court. But if you're not on government land, and if you're not a government resident, you can force the jurisdiction to go into common law. So in common law, there's no judge in there pulling any hanky panky. Each party has to do their own talking. They can't have an attorney do it for them. And nobody's going to get between the evidence and the jury. So if you got evidence to show the jury, the judge doesn't get to decide, you know, what the jury gets to see. So, you have a lot more, playing field there. So you'd want to bring those cases in under common law. And when you bring them under common law, the state doesn't get anything out of it. So they don't have a agenda to, steal your children and destroy the marriage and, push for divorce and all that stuff. And, you know, whatever. They make money on chaos. So that's what we do. When there's a domestic divorce, for example, we go right into court, and let's say the wife has got a feminist agenda, which a lot of them do nowadays, which is sad. And they're going to throw the husband out. They're going to throw him out of the house. They're going to throw him out of the business. And we go right in, and we challenge the court's jurisdiction. We challenge if there's even a marriage license. If you don't live on government land when you get that marriage license, you don't have a state marriage license. That state marriage license is based on residency. And residency is based on if you live on government land. Now, if you're a U.S. citizen, you're perpetually domiciled in the District of Columbia. So that's the marriage license evidence is there. But if you're naturally born on, let's say, Texas land, and you don't live on the land in Texas that is of the government, there's no residence issue, and you don't qualify, you're not eligible, you're not required to go in and get a marriage license. And if you did get a marriage license, it was given to you fraudulently, and there is no, it's not active, and it doesn't have no force and effect of law. So anyway, so the jurisdiction defaults to a common law. Common law, each party has to speak for themselves. They can't have an attorney, and the judge is only a referee, and the jury decides all the law and the fact of the case. Very interesting.
Oh, extremely, especially that marriage license angle you threw in there. Thank you. That was great.
Yeah, same way with driver's license. You can't get a driver's license unless you're a resident, state resident. Think about it. Okay, next question.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate you. All right, next is Norm and then Jennifer and then good night. So we'll go with Norm.
Yeah, I was listening to a conversation about this Social Security number that changed a while back from the real number to an encrypted number. Not sure, you didn't really cover it, but what they did, they took the real number and did an encryption on it in order to hide the number and create an all alpha symbol, which is a security number, on the Medicare card. That's why they did it that way, just in case you didn't know.
Well, thank you.
Well, I would believe that there's no full disclosure there and there's no contract, so I don't think that would fly if they tried to do that. Hold that against me. But the you got to qualify for that Social Security number. You got to be eligible to have one. Most people are not, so they can't use that against you, and they don't in U.S. courts. You challenge the Social Security number for evidence, does the court have a jurisdiction? The judges, every time I've ever witnessed it, the judge runs away from it. He doesn't want to go down that dark alley.
Yeah, I'm old enough that I originally had a Social Security number with the actual number there. Then a few years ago, they sent me a new card with the encrypted symbol, which is all alpha. So... I asked them about it. They asked Social Security about it. They said, yeah, it was for security purposes.
What do you mean encrypted? Encrypted? I don't understand what you're talking about.
They took the Social Security number and randomized the number to an all-alpha 16-digit number.
I've never seen a 16-digit.
Well, what a 4-8, it's four times four. 4, 8, and 8 is 12, 16. Yeah, I'm looking at it here. Look at my Social Security number. It's all out.
Is that your Social Security? Well, when you fill out a government form, they only have enough space in there for 3, 2, and then 4.
Well. Let me tell you what my Social Security number is here.
Can I open up a bank account?
Okay.
The
number is 4 Quebec Charlie 9 Alpha X-ray 3 November Quebec 22. Yeah, it's 434. You're correct. I missed it by one digit.
So anyway, okay, well, we'll do some more kicking around on that and research. And either way, it's a number that the only way that I've never heard of a number, any Social Security number ever harming you if you know how to challenge it properly in court. They don't want to go down that dark alley because there's it. But anyway, next question then.
Thank you, Norm.
Yeah, I'm done.
Appreciate you. All right, thank you.
Yeah.
And next and last is Miss Jennifer. Go right ahead.
Hi. It's not really a question. It's just that everyone I know that has come into the United States, including myself, we had to be sponsored to come in. So I was sponsored by a religious organization as a worker for them. And, like, my daughter's husband was sponsored by my husband's brother because he made enough money to sponsor him, whereas my husband didn't. So everyone has to be sponsored somehow. And then every 10 years, you have to just go and renew your visa. So I don't understand why people just don't do that and let the visa run out, and then there's a million problems. But if you just go every 10 years and re-sign up, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, maybe the provision is there. I don't know if the government I don't know if the government can require a man to get a visa, even. If I have that 1,000 acres and I invite you to come in and live on that land, I mean, you can live on that land, but you can go anywhere in America and travel and just like anybody else.
Coming in with the permission way, not the way. I mean, if you want to come, if you come in with permission from the government, all you have to do is get it every 10 years, and there's not an issue. So the people create their own problems when they just don't do that. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah, that might be true. I had a friend that used to deal with a lot of money, and he said he could jump on a Learjet in America, talk to nobody, fly to Switzerland, land at the airport, have $1 million in a briefcase. The people from Switzerland would board the plane and ask, you know, what's his business here? And he would just simply say that I'm going down and do some banking, and it's private business. And he said he said nobody would even ask his name or nothing. They would just let him go. And he said it was pretty interesting.
They invited a plane.
It was a private jet, yeah.
Oh yeah.
He left America with nobody asking him or nobody knowing, and he would land there and nobody knowing, and he would completely anonymous.
Well, he did follow a flight plan. I promise you that.
That's why I paid big bucks.
What'd you say, Michael?
Jennifer, I said he did file a flight plan. The pilot filed a flight plan. Anyways, thank you all for joining us this evening. We've had our largest attendance tonight that PJ's ever had, and I'm grateful and thankful to you all. Please share this call with other people. Every week, I attempt to give a different twist on jurisdiction, so we'll find out what I come up with next week. And every week, PJ's got something great to talk about with regards to jurisdiction. It's the key and foundation to everything in this country. If you think that you're free and you're a federal citizen, I've got court cases to show you that you are property. You heard the word property. Just as colonists were subject to the king, property of the king, just as today's Americans of African descent, their progeny, their progenitors were property at one time, today the United States figures everyone is their property in the United States. And I've got court cases to prove it. Sad. So let us show you how to get off the plantation. Let us show you how to live your life as a free man and free woman. Until then, good night, everybody. Next week, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.